You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Brookings. And for those of you visiting, welcome to Washington, D.C. My name is Bruce Jones. I'm the Vice President for Foreign Policy here at the Brookings Institution. And on behalf of the Center for East Asia Policy, it's my pleasure to welcome you to today's discussion on the future of U.S.-Japan trade relations at this key moment, not only in U.S.-Japan bilateral relations, but at a critical moment that may redefine America's role in Asia. The United States has withdrawn from the negotiations and the conclusion of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement. It's currently renegotiating the North American Free Trade Agreement and is in the midst of significant trade tensions with China, Canada, and the European Union, some of its largest trade partners. Against this backdrop, how the United States chooses at this moment to engage with Japan, another of its largest trade partners and a key ally in Asia, is an important barometer for the Trump administration's commitment to the international economic order and to Asian security more broadly. In contrast, Japan has taken a leadership role on trade issues, relaunching the Trans-Pacific Partnership among the remaining 11 members and successfully signing the agreement in March 2018, a feat that few thought at the time would be possible. Our own Maria Solis was among the very first to advocate for Japan to rescue the TPP project, identifying the opportunities for a more proactive Japan, a theme that's highlighted in her recent book, Dilemmas of a Trading Nation, which I strongly encourage you to buy at Amazon.com. As Japan redefines its role, new questions emerge as to what other areas it can help advance in the rules-based multilateral trading system and in the constructions of a regional architecture in Asia. At various points in the history of the two countries, trade has been a thorny issue between the United States and Japan, but striking the right balance between domestic interests and international commitments may never have been more important than it is right now. Today, we're delighted to have a group of Japanese politicians and Japanese and American policy experts to offer their perspectives on U.S.-Japan trade relations, the future of bilateral and multilateral trade arrangements in the region, and the scope for U.S.-Japan cooperation on regional economic issues, including in dealing with a resurgent China. Very much warm welcome to our panel of distinguished Japanese guests, and a major thank you to Tsuyoshi Sunohara of the Japan Center for Economic Research and a longtime friend of Brookings for bringing this group to Washington. It is part of our ongoing conversation with Japanese scholars and the government around key issues in their relationship. We will begin with keynote remarks from Mr. Amari and follow with a panel discussion of our experts. Akira Amari is a member of the ruling Liberal Democratic Party and holds a seat in the House of Representatives. First elected in 1983, he is currently serving his 12th term in office. Over his career, he has held several leadership positions in the Diet and the LDP, and most recently has served as Minister of State for Economic Policy and Fiscal Policy until January 2016. And in that capacity, he served as Japan's negotiator for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's our very great pleasure to have him here at Brookings, and please join me in welcoming Mr. Amari to the stage.
ご紹介をいただきました甘利明です、日本語で、20分ほどお話をさせていただきます
Thank you for the introduction. My name is Akira Amari. I will be speaking to you through interpreter.
中国では、現金が、信用されないこともあって電子決済が国の隅々まで行き渡っていますご案内のとおりです、アリペイとかウィーチャットペイ、日常の決済のすべてが電子決済化をしております
In China, as you know, sometimes cash is not trusted, so the e-payment is spread out throughout the country. Something like eCha Pay is used broadly in the country, and all of the transactions and payments are done mostly in e-payment.
国中に監視カメラが設置をされております。田舎の町の隅々まで。そして顔認証システムと相まって個人の特定が極めて容易にできます。
And there are surveillance cameras placed throughout the country, even in a very remote rural areas as well, and used in combination with face recognition system, the identification of individual is done very easily.
犯罪は随分減ったようでありますけれども、個人情報の秘匿というのはほぼ無視をされています。
Although the crime rate has gone down significantly, there is still a concern about the protection of individual private information.
インターネット上に習近平のバカ野郎と書きますと、直ちに買い物ができなくなります。車が呼べなくなります。電車に乗れなくなります。歩いて街に出れば、監視カメラと顔認証で個人が特定され、あっという間に公安がやってきてどっかへ連れ去られます。
So if you wrote on the internet, for example, foolish Xi Jinping or something, then you will not be able to do internet shopping anymore. You can't ride cars anymore. You can't ride trains anymore. If you go out on your foot to the town, then you are caught by surveillance camera, and the police will come out and arrest you.
これは中国のインターネットプラットフォーマーの役員が真顔で日本の企業の役員に言った言葉であります。
This was heard from the CEO of Internet Platform Company, or the executive of the Internet Platform Company, to another Internet Platform Company in Japan.
その中国の、インターネットプラットフォーマーの一つ、アリババのジャック・マー CEO は今2020年東京オリンピック関係者に全面協力の申し出をかなり強烈に行っています。
And one of those internet platform companies is called Alibaba, and the company's CEO, Mr. Jack Ma, is proposing to 100% back up and collaborate and help with the Tokyo Olympic in 2020.
東京オリンピックを機会に日本の、決済システムキャッシュレス化を図ろうという目論みです。アリペイを日本全土に敷いていこうということです。これにはおそらく、アリババの株を800億ドル以上持っているソフトバンクが協力をするのではないかと思います。決済システムには日本の銀行が協力をする必要があります。ソフトバンクと連携しているみずほ銀行がおそらく意欲を示します。
So probably the intention is that using the Tokyo Olympic as the a trigger, Alibaba would like to expand the payment system or cashless system in Japan and expand their Alipay system throughout Japan. And SoftBank, who has the stake of $80 billion of Alibaba, will probably help out with that initiative. And also, in order to set up a payment system, you need help of a bank in Japan. And Mizuho Bank, which is the bank for SoftBank, will probably help out as well.
そして、Alibaba は中国版 Uber と言えるデイデイという会社を持っています、そのシステムをおそらくこの機会に東京を中心に敷いていこうということであります。
Alibaba also owns a company called DayDay, which is a Chinese version of Uber. So taking that opportunity, they will probably try to expand that system in Japan as well.
そうしますと、DayDay やアリペイを通じて、移動情報、それから決済情報、すべてがアリババの、データベースに、アリクラウドに集約をされるということになります。
And what this will lead to is that through DayDay and Alipay, they will seize all the information on movement of people as well as payment information, and that will be all gathered in database of Alibaba, AliCloud.
日本には世界ナンバーワンのデータベースがあります。それは1億2000万人、介護保険制度による医療と介護のデータベースです。これは量質両方とっても世界一であります。
And at the same time, Japan has the number one database in the world. This is the database system for universal insurance system. Information about insurance as well as the nursing care is all gathered for the all 120 million people. So in terms of volume as well as quality, it is the number one database system.
アリペイの決済システムが詳細な設計で医療機関、介護機関に全部入っていきますと、そのデータがすべてアリクラウドに集まってまいります。
And Alipay, if they go into using their design architecture, if they go into the system of insurance and also into the systems or hospital systems, then all that information will also be concentrated into AliCloud.
中国は習近平主席の政治体制と、そして21世紀のインフラたる、デジタルプラットフォーマーが完璧に組んで、経済戦略、それを政治戦略、統治戦略として展開をしていきます。
In China, these 21st century infrastructure platform companies or digital platform companies are working very tightly with the Xi Jinping, President Xi Jinping's administration. And they work in combination to form economic, political, as well as investment strategies.
アメリカの GAFA に対して中国は BATJ と言われています。バイドゥ、アリババ、テンセント、ジンドン。その4社はデジタル世界のプラットフォーマーであります。彼らは習近平主席から国家企業になれと言われればそれをも受け入れますということをはっきり言っています。
So there's GAFA in the US and there's BATJ in China. These are Baidu, Alibaba, Tencent and Jingdong. These are the 21st century digital platform companies in China. And they have made it clear that they are ready to become a nationally owned company if they were told so.
Alibaba は国内を出て今 ASEAN に入りました。ASEAN の最大の電子商取引のシステムを買収をいたしました。ASEAN の電子商取引はアリババの傘下に入っていきます。
Alibaba has gone out of China and expanded into ASEAN now. They have just acquired the largest e-commerce system in ASEAN countries. So that means that the e-commerce system itself will go under Alibaba now in ASEAN.
プラットフォーマー4社はこのビジネスモデルを東南アジアから中東、アフリカに敷いていけという指示を受けているはずであります。そしてそのために障害があることであるならば全力で中国国家政府がその障害を取り除いていくということを約束をしているはずです。
So it is suspected that these platform, four platform companies' business model is to go from Southeast Asia and expand into Middle East as well as to Africa. That is the instruction that they have received. And if there is any obstacles, then the Chinese government will back them up 100% and try and remove those obstacles for those companies.
習近平政府が、バッド J に与えている指示はたった一つです。その条件として情報はすべてよこせということです。
And in return for helping them out, the one thing that Xi administration is asking to those bad J companies is to provide all the information that they gather in the way.
さらに、中国政府は2020年東京オリンピックを目指して、宇宙から地理の測定衛星 GPS 衛星を今の22機から35機体制に、敷いていきます。
And furthermore, Chinese government is planning towards the upcoming Tokyo Olympic in 2020 to increase the number of GPS satellites from a current 22 units to 35 units.
合わせてそれのと連携を取る地上局を2000局にします。
And at the same time, increase the number of base stations to 2000.
これで自動運転の誤差は10ミリ以内になります。そしてこのシステムを運行するソフトウェアは、Baidu が AI を使って作り上げたものを関係協力企業に無償で配布をしています。これにはアメリカの企業もヨーロッパの企業も参加しています。
And with this system set up with the satellite and the base station, the margin of error will shrink to 10 millimeters for autonomous vehicles.And the software to navigate these autonomous vehicles is developed by Baidu using artificial intelligence. And they are distributed with no charge to related companies. Companies that include American companies as well as European companies.
つまり、一帯一路の国々は中国のハードシステム、ソフトシステムの運営のもとにすべて運行がなされることを目標としているわけであります。そしてこの自動走行システムは陸だけではありません。船の自動航行システムも同時にこのシステムで管理をしていきます。一帯一路は陸も海も中国のコントロール下に置かれるということです。
And companies that fall into a Belt and Road Initiative will, that means that they will run under Chinese control in terms of hardware as well as software. That is the target of China. And this autonomous navigation system is not only for the land, but also for the ships that go on the ocean. They will also be controlled by the same system. Belt and Road Initiative will cover both land and ocean.
つまり世界中のどこの船が今どこにいるかということは全部把握できるわけであります。
So that means then you know which ship is where exactly in the world.
中国にはサイバーセキュリティ法っていうのがあります。この法律によって国家安全保障上という理由で中国で得られるあらゆる情報は中国から外に持ち出すことはできません。しかし外の情報は自由に中国に集めることができるという一方通行制度であります。
In China, there's a law called Cyber Security Act, and this is a rather one-way system where, because of the security reason, any information that is gathered within the country cannot be taken out of the country, whereas any information that is gathered outside the country could be freely concentrated into the country.
本来、インターネット電子商取引が備えていかない。いなければならない3つの自由原則があります。1つは情報の国境移動の自由であります。2つはサーバーのローカライゼーションを禁止をするということであります。3つ目は、ソースコードの開示要求はしてはならないという原則であります。
Originally, the principles of electronic commerce is that there should be a free flow of information across the border. And secondly, a ban on the requirement for localization of servers. And the third is the ban on the requirement to disclose source code.
中国にはこの3つの原則はありません。自分の情報は外へ一切出さない。人の情報は自由自在に入れてデータベース化をしていく。情報も技術も人も中国は取り放題。中国からは大事なものは一切出さないというシステムが一帯一路の戦略のもとにやがてアフリカまで進んでいきます。
But this, these principles do not exist in China. Basically, they will never take the information out of the country, whereas they gather information and bring into the country freely from outside and put them all into their database. So they're free to take all the information, technology and people from outside, but nothing goes out the country. And such system will be deployed under Belt and Road Initiative, and that will surely reach the U.S. one day.
中国製のプラットフォーマー、BAT-J は本来アメリカのプラットフォーマー GAFA のコピーモデルです。コピーモデルを中国の大市場の中に囲い込んで本家のモデルの介入を許さず、その消費力を使って拡大させ、本家よりも大きな企業にして、そして海外展開をさせているわけです。
Now, these bad J's, or the digital platform companies in China, are basically the copy models of American's platform companies, GAFA. So what China did was to put them in the Chinese market. The copy models are nurtured within the Chinese market and did not allow the original GAFA companies from outside to go into their own markets so that their own companies can grow and expand and become even bigger than the original companies and expand into other countries.
Amazon もアリババも同等に中国本土で使えますよと彼らは言います。しかしアマゾンは1日30分だけ妨害電波で必ず使えなくなります。よってアリババを使うしかないです。
And of course they say that you can use both Amazon and Alibaba equally in our country. But every day there's a time there is a interfering signals that would make Amazon not usable for a certain period of time, for 30 minutes. That means that you have to go to Alibaba to surf on the internet.
我々は世界中がフェアに同条件で使えるデジタルインフラを作っていかなきゃならないんです。それにこれからどうしていくかということが課題なんです。
But our mission is to create a digital infrastructure where everybody can use it in a fair manner and with the same conditions throughout the world. And that is our challenge going forward.
TPP は関税を限りなくゼロにするというようなことだけに焦点が今の政権では当たっています。しかし TPP が大事なのはルールです。トランプ大統領が 中国を名指しでアンフェアな国であると、知財を盗み技術移転を強要しソースコードを開示させ自由な情報取引をさせず違法な農業補助金をかける、こう非難しています。 TPP では全てがルールとして禁止をされているわけであります。つまりトランプ大統領の主張をそっくりルール化したのが TPP です。
Now, TPP、is、today the focus on TPP is、aboutreducing the tariff、very close to zero. And that is the focus of the current administration. But actually what is important regarding TPP is the set of rules that apply. President Trump criticizes China about being very unfair. They steal IP, force the technology transfer, they force disclosure of source code, and hamper the free flow of information and give out subsidiary for agricultural products. But these are all the things that are covered in TPP and are banned. So what is advocated by Mr. Trump is really the rules of TPP.
TPP は来年早々にも発行いたします。そして、タイが正式に参加希望をしてきました。南米コロンビアも手を挙げています。台湾も挙げてくると思います。 TPP フェアなこの誰もが参加できるルールを世界ルールとしていくことが一番大事なんです。ルールはフェアなものを作りました。次は執行力が必要なんであります。世界に敷いていく力が必要です。そのためにはアメリカのプレゼンスが必要なんです。
TPP will go into effect early next year. Thai has officially decided to participate, and Colombia is interested, and I think Taiwan will soon declare its interest in the system. TPP's principle is it's a very fair system where everybody can participate. So the global standard and global rule is the important factor of this entire system. So now the rule is set up as a very fair rule, and now what is necessary is the execution and capability to execute.Because we have to look at the world when we try to do something like this. And that is the reason why we need the presence of the U.S.
TPP は安倍総理とオバマ大統領が作り上げたものではありません。日本とアメリカが作り上げたものなんです。
Well, TPP was not something created by President Obama and Prime Minister Abe. It was created by Japan and the U.S.
日本とアメリカがタッグを組むことの重要性をお話をし、私のスピーチといたします。ありがとうございました。
So I would like to again reiterate the importance of U.S. and Japan working together. Thank you very much.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Mireya Solis. I am the Knight Chair in Japan Studies and co-director at the Center for East Asia Policy Studies. It's really a pleasure to welcome this very distinguished group of panelists. And I would like to start by thanking Minister Amari for a really deep set of insights that he shared with us. I think that he has correctly highlighted what is an essential issue for U.S.-Japan going forward, and that is how to deal with a rising China and a China that now has this larger digital footprint and is using it to these purposes that Minister Amari highlighted. And also I very much appreciate his comments on the significance of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement. So I think that Minister Amari has already put on the table many significant issues for all of us to discuss. Before we do so, I would like to then introduce our other guests. So if I may, Yoshimasa Hayashi is a member of the House of Councillors from the Liberal Democratic Party. Currently, he serves as the Minister of Education, Culture, Sports, Science and Technology. And as his past cabinet positions include Minister of Agriculture and Minister of Defense. Ryan Haas is Rubinstein Fellow in the Foreign Policy Program. And before joining Brookings, he was a director for China, Taiwan, and Mongolia at the National Security Council. Koichiro Gemba is an independent member of the House of Representatives. And previously, he was a member of the Democratic Party of Japan and served as a Minister for Foreign Affairs and Minister for National Policy, among other positions. Minister Amari already...
I'm independent.
Independent, yes. And Akihiko Tanaka is president of the National Graduate Institute for Policy Studies, GRIPS. And between 2012 and 2015, he served as president of the Japan International Cooperation Agency. So as you could reflect, based on Minister Amari's keynote speech today, we're indeed living in very important, fluid times. There's so much to discuss. We need to talk about the role that the United States is going to play in the international economic system. We need to talk about how to deepen U.S.-Japan economic relations at a time when the United States government is talking about a bilateral agenda, and Japan is insisting that the Trans-Pacific Partnership has tremendous value, especially when considered the role that China is acquiring, again, in international economic governance. And I think there's a very significant agenda as to how Japan and the United States could work together in addressing constructively but effectively the China challenge. Now, because Minister Hayashi has to catch a plane and he joined us just for a few minutes, I want to ask Minister Hayashi if you could reflect also on the remarks from Minister Amari. Mm-hmm. And especially when it comes to the TPP and the fact that the TPP has had a second lease of life. Mm. If I may recall, a year and a half ago, when President Trump made good on his promise to withdraw from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, I think it's fair to say that the conventional wisdom was that the TPP was finished, that the agreement would die because the United States was not part of it. And we know that Japan's leadership has been instrumental in delivering a very different outcome. So the question I have for you is, how come Japan was able to be proactive at this very critical juncture, given that many people had assumed that Japan would always play defensive, especially when it came to trade because of its own sensitivity, say, on agriculture? Yeah. So where does Japanese leadership spring from?
Thank you, Soria, for... First of all, good morning, everybody, and thank you for your consideration to let me speak first to catch the airplane to go into Beijing. So the trade and China is not my jurisdiction as a minister for education, culture, science, technology, sports. So let me speak as a former agriculture minister. And I had a very fond memory of working together with Minister Amari then, the chief negotiator of TPP, and he is always bugging me, why do you don't do more, right? but now we came to the conclusion. And what happened before and after TPP, because uh, agriculture situation really changing in Japan thanks to TPP, and prior to that there was Australia-Japan FTA trade negotiation, and it's already started in action. So that's a mindset change in Japanese farmers and growers, that we can not simply defending ourselves, but we can do offense. Offense means not attacking somebody, but export. So if you notice that our products, it's very nice, you know, Japanese cuisine is number one, a popular cuisine in all over the world now, especially after the Milano Food Expo several years ago. Why not export, which produced the Japanese cuisine? So that's why when I get the position late 2012, I, you know, consult with Prime Minister and let's set the target, doubling the export from almost 4. Billion U.S. dollars at that time to 1 trillion yen, which is doubling in almost 7 years, aiming the year of the Olympic game. It doesn't matter, Olympic or Paralympic, or, but that's the setting goal. And nobody believes at the beginning that we could do that. But now, last year, we see $8.0 billion. It's already almost doubled and reaching to that 1 trillion yen goal 2 years left. So I think, for example, Japanese beef, maybe you have heard about or you have eaten Japanese very nice Kobe beef or something like that. But now it is sold in London famous market that $100 per 100 gram. So it's almost double the price in Japan, and they're selling the same quality of Australian beef at 60% of that, and the domestic beef is less than 10% of that price. So if you started to sell that, and if you have a nice brand image, and if you have nice marketing, then we can export. And that now have more wider acceptance and wider range of the understanding in Japanese growers too. So the mindset is changing, but while still very small size farmers in Japan is producing rice, but also we started reform for this main growing in Japan so that the more accumulation of land to a more younger and energetic farmers, whereas the elderly farmers are retiring. So we are doing prefecture by prefecture have some type of the farming land bank so that they can accumulate that. And also we abolish the agriculture subsidy starting this year, actually, or last year, so that rather than relying on the subsidy, regardless of the quality which is paid, we abolish that and use that budget for income insurance, so that if something bad weather happens, the market goes down, income insurance covers that loss. But if you make more sales than that, then you will enjoy that. So the farmers becoming more like independent, manager, rather than just making the same things and selling the same price to the Nokia. And now Nokia changed also that the trading sector of the Nokia already talking about joint investment in former East European countries to produce some of the, using Japanese technologies, producing some of the grapes to make some wines over there. So it's changing in Japan. But still, there's a mindset still remains that they have to be protected. So we have to be very careful about the political meaning of further opening up the, as an image, because 2 years ago, our party lost almost all the upper house seat in Tohoku areas. So still, there's some, this is also the flip side of the coin, that image still very strongly hated by the as general, that more opening up in the Nikkei newspapers, but that kind of article is still not so good for a political meaning. So having said that, Just briefly on China, because I'm visiting Beijing from now, I hope that the budget is a hidden abbreviation for Bud Japan, but since I really echo with the what Ms. Amari said, that we thought that maybe China will hit the middle income trap, but using that budget strategies, they are now having innovation, quote unquote, and maybe by doing that, they can circumvent the middle-income trap. So innovation seems to be happening because they're bringing those innovation from the United States to have that for 1.2 billion people. That's the biggest market in the world. So that's why how those innovation evolves in China, whereas which resulted in the more bigger economic power, which resulted in more defense spending. So that's we have to think together bilaterally with the U.S. and Japan. And I stop here and really looking forward to listening to your debate, but sorry about leaving soon to catch the flight. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Minister Hayashi, for those excellent comments. And I concur completely with the importance of domestic measures that allow countries to be more proactive. Mm-hmm. I think that in the United States, we have painfully learned that lesson with the situation we find ourselves in, and also the importance of domestic politics, and I want to get that in a second. But I also wanted to ask Minister Amari if he could reflect about that decision point when Japan decided that it would put its weight behind resurrecting TPP. You were the leading negotiator of the original TPP. So if you could share, what was your thought when you saw the United States actually leaving the agreement? And what do you think then carried the day in deliberations among government officials in Japan that indeed the TPP should continue and that Japan should be playing this proactive role now?
TPP11 というのは1枚のペーパーだけです。 TPP12 というのは数千ページからなるものです。ですから TPP11 は TPP12 が合意に至ったから、まあ交渉が成り立ったことは事実で、あります。
Now, TPP 11 is concentrated into one sheet of paper, whereas TPP 12 originally had thousands of pages. So that means that TPP 11 was possible because there was an original negotiation on TPP 12.
TPP 12で一番苦労をしたのはですね、いくつかありますけど、一つは途上国がこれだけそのハイスタンダードについてこれるかっていうことでした。でこれは、彼らは勇気を持って克服をしました。その一番大きなそのモチベーションになったのはですね、 TPP という外圧を利用して国内改革を図るという決意をしたからです。
So one of the things that we most struggled with, there are several, but one of them is that we were concerned if some of the developing countries, were they able to keep up with such high standard. But they actually overcame such difficulties boldly. Then one of the largest motivation for doing so was that they wanted to, or they were determined to carry out reform domestically using such external pressure.
で、先進国に関して困ったことは2つありました。1つはアメリカ。アメリカは決めてくれないということです。つまり、交渉の最終日タイムリミットの5分前まで交渉を続けるという国だからです。
And there were two things that struggled with regarding the developed countries. One is about the U.S. U.S. Just could not decide. They would not decide until 5 minutes before the time limit.
もう一つはカナダ。ウィシュワシ。
The second was Korea, as you heard, wishy-washy.
Canada,
I'm sorry.
で、TPP-11 でもやっぱ最後まで苦労したのはカナダを説得することだと承知してます。
And what I understand is that also during the TPP-11 negotiation, the negotiators struggled throughout the negotiation and to the very end to convince Canada.
でもカナダの首相は、ダボス会議で、私がこの成果を上げましたと演説をされたそうです。
At the same time, Prime Minister of Canada said in Davos that this was my achievement.
まあでもよくできたからよかったですよ。
But in the end, it all worked out.
Thank you very much. Very interesting, Minister Amari. So I would like to bring Minister Gemba and talk about the domestic politics, because now we have a signed comprehensive and progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement that now must be ratified. And it's interesting in the news that Mexico was the first country to ratify just a few days ago, the TPP-11. And, you know, Japanese politics is going through an interesting period, to put it mildly, today. Do you expect that there would be a delay in Diet deliberations regarding the TPP ratification because of the political situation? How do you see, from a different point of view, from a different now an independent, the prospects for TPP ratification, the new TPP ratification in Japan, timeline, for example?
まああの国会の対応についてのご質問でありましたけれど、確かに日本としては、できるだけ早く国会を通したいというのが政府の意思だというふうに思います。
This was a question about how the Diet session will go regarding this issue. Of course, the government's intention is to pass the bill as soon as possible in Japan.
でもあの政府がその気ならですね、今は与党が圧倒的多数なので、まあ、様々なスキャンダルで国会が止まったりもしておりますけれども強い意思があればさほどですね通過に時間がかかるとは思えない。
However, if the government is very serious, I do not think it will take very long time since a government or ruling party has the overwhelming majority in a diet. Although a diet session sometimes halts because of some scandals within the political world, but with the strong will of the government, I think it's possible.
もちろん野党は野党という立場もあるから、問題点があればですね、それを指摘するのは一つの責任だというふうに思います。
But of course, opposition parties have their own roles. So if there is any issues, then that's their responsibility to point that out.
他方ですね、甘利先生が、まあ、先ほど非常に素晴らしい話を私はされたと思いますし、また TPP-12 をまとめた功績は私は大変大きいと思っています。
Well, at the same time, Mr. Amari made excellent points earlier, and I think the achievement is rather significant that now today we have TPP-12.
実は交渉の前段階でアメリカのオバマ政権から TPP をやらないかと言われたときに、私がたまたま担当大臣でした。
So before even before everything started, the negotiations started, I just happened to be the minister responsible for these issues when Obama administration proposed the idea of TPP to us.
内閣府の特命担当大臣で国家戦略担当大臣という立場だったんです。
I was the minister of a state for the domestic strategy within the cabinet office.
その時にも自分自身も強調していたのはこの TPP の持つですね戦略的経済的意義を強調してました。
And I stressed the importance and significance of TPP in terms of a strategy as well as economy.
多分この TPP12 から TPP11 になって、つまりアメリカ抜きの TPP11 だと、おそらく日本だけ見れば、しかも短期的に見れば、プラスよりマイナスの方が大きいかもしれません。
If you look at or if you compare TPP 12 against TPP 11 that is without the US and just look at the Japanese side and on a very short term there might be more shortcomings than the benefits to Japan.
だけど先ほどあまり先生がおっしゃった通り世界全体をフェアなルールにするそのことに対して、まあ、残念ながらアメリカが今秩序の形成者というかそういうソフトな必要な国際公共財を提供してくれる状況にないので日本としてですねそれをしっかりサポートするというか日本としてこの自由貿易あるいは法の支配なんかもそうなんですけれどそういったソフトな公共財を提供するそういう責任と役割があるということだと思っています。
However, as Mr. Amari pointed out in his speech, the significance of TPP is that to provide fair rules to the world as a whole. Unfortunately, the U.S. is not right now in the position to form orders around the world and to provide public goods in terms of fairness. So that means that Japan will need to step in, and we are responsible for helping out and setting free trade as well as rule of law.
もう一つだけいいですか？
はい、お願いします。 One
more point. アメリカにとってFTA より FTA より TPP の方がいいというふうに私は思っています。
One more point is that I believe for the US, TPP is more beneficial than FTA.
例えば牛肉のこれはもうルールというよりは関税の話だけしますけれど、38.5% の関税が今アメリカの牛肉が日本に入るときにかかっています。
So, for example, just talking about tariffs rather than the rule for beef, when the U.S. beef comes into Japan, there's a tariff of 38.5%.
でも日本はもうオーストラリアと EPA を結び、かつ TPP11 が始まれば、もうアメリカ以外の牛肉は 9% まで下がるわけです。
But Japan has APA already set up with Australia, and with the TPP, we'll work with other countries as well. And all the other countries, except for the U.S., tariff will go down to 9%.
豚肉も日本と EU で EPA が結ばれて、デンマークの豚肉なんかがどんどん関税が安くなって日本に入ってきます。
And same thing for pork. We already have EPA between Japan and EU, and Danish pork will come in at much cheaper price.
FTA を日米でやろうと思えば、おそらく5年から10年は間違いなくかかると思います。
And if we try to work on FTA between Japan and the US, and it'll probably take maybe between 5 to 10 years to negotiate.
そう考えると、アメリカにとっても TPP に入った方が得だと。いうのが私の考えです。
So, if in that sense, it might be more beneficial for the U.S. to just join a TPP.
以上です。
Thank you very much, Minister Gemba. Those were very insightful comments, and I very much concur that the United States has much greater benefits to reap from rejoining TPP than starting from scratch a bilateral negotiation, something that we'll also come to discuss in a few minutes. But I want to transition to the China challenge, because that has been, I think, an overriding concern in our conversation, so I want now to put it front and center and to bring my colleague Ryan Haas and Professor Tanaka to this discussion. Minister Amari, in his keynote, talked about this ecosystem that the Chinese government and some companies are creating, where the Chinese government may facilitate access in exchange for information, and very much discussed events in the digital space and the connection to the Belt Road Initiative. So I thought it would be beneficial now if we could discuss, for example, Ryan, if you can get us started, and then Tanaka Sensei, if you can also share, what do you think are China's objectives and motivations behind the Belt Road Initiative, and what can we tell from the way in which some of the projects have been implemented? Is China on track in accomplishing those objectives, or do we see already significant hurdles to the implementation of that grand connectivity strategy? So, Ryan, and then Tanaka Sensei.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Maria, for including me in this conversation. Mm-hmm. If I could, I'd like to start out where Minister Amari stopped, which is, I think, at the root of any conversation that we have here or in Tokyo or anywhere else, it's important to have a recognition that the cornerstone of U.S. strategy in Asia is our alliance with Japan, and everything needs to start from there. Without a strong, stable, steady, solid alliance with Japan, it's really not possible to advance U.S. strategy the way we'd like. To address Maria's question about the Belt and Road Initiative, the conventional wisdom in Washington, which I think is familiar to many people here, is that it's part of a grand Chinese strategy to establish centrality and to eventually dominate the region and eventually the world. And I don't dispute that necessarily, but I think that using such a caricature sort of underappreciates the drivers of Chinese policy behind the Belt and Road Initiative. From my perspective, it's much more instructive to look at the initiative from the inside out rather than the outside in. In other words, I think that there are very significant domestic drivers that are pushing forward the Belt and Road Initiative. And I'll just offer a few to kick off the conversation. The first is China has excess capital that it needs to find a productive outlet for. And if it does not, it runs risk of inflation inside of China. And so the Belt and Road Initiative provides a vehicle for getting capital outside of China in pursuit of productive investments abroad. Similarly, we all know that China has a problem with excess capacity. It produces too much steel, too much cement, too much aluminum, too much of many things. It needs to find a place to send all this excess capacity, and if it doesn't, it will have to shut down factories and risk localized spikes in unemployment, which is a problem that the Belt and Road Initiative is trying to address. The third, as infrastructure projects inside China begin to slow down and China's economy transitions from an investment-based economy to a more consumption-based economy, its state-owned enterprises need somewhere to go and something to do. The Belt and Road Initiative is designed to advantage Chinese state-owned enterprises. And then fourth, I think that it is a useful tool for President Xi in terms of building morale and unity of purpose within China and stoking pride within China that China is embarking on a grand historic project. It's something that everyone in China can understand, appreciate, and it invokes China returning to its historic place at the center of a hub-and-spokes model throughout Asia. So all that to say that there certainly are very clear strategic objectives. I think that Minister Amari outlined several of them this morning. It's clear that China would like to establish standards around the world. It's clear that China would like to position itself as the center of Asia and abroad. But unless we understand what domestic problems China is using the Belt and Road Initiative to try to address, I don't think that we can fully appreciate where the initiative will be headed.
Excellent. Tanaka Sensei?
I believe the broad goal of the Belt and Road Initiative is to achieve what many Chinese call China's dream. However, what does China's dream constitute? means many things to many different people. And in my understanding, Belt and Initiative are the result of various pressures, as Ryan just mentioned, from China. And so in the end, it's a sort of a mixed bag, which with the potential of China's the power of cash, a lot of people have been frightened. But I think today's keynote speech by Mr. Amari has really contributed to focus our attention to one of the key areas of at least concerns of the international friends. So far, I think international attention with respect to Belt and Road initiatives have been more or less focused on China's attempt to build a lot of physical infrastructures, railroad, port facilities, and things like that. But in my understanding, given a few years' experiences, the concerns about those physical infrastructure, big projects, have been rather exaggerated. Mm-hmm. China has made lots of commitments with a huge number of cash that China can, you know, bring into. But many of these projects, if you look at the concrete performance, not you know, quickly implemented as China promised. Well, there are concerns about those fiscal infrastructure development. Well, firstly, because at least some of them have problems of the debt sustainability for recipient countries. This could risk the sound development of regional countries in the Belt and Road areas. Well, Sri Lanka's Hambantota port case is quite indicative. When Sri Lankan government found out that they were not able to repay, then, well, they may end up with a debt-equity swap by which Chinese companies gain the control of port facilities. And now there may be certain, you know, concerns about railroad projects from China to Laos to Thailand. There may be some the problem with debt sustainability for the country like Laos, whose GDP is not so big. And this debt sustainability problem may create certain security concerns for the regional countries, particularly to India, that with this Chinese expansion to Sri Lanka or Maldives, that might create some security problems. And so I believe these are important and relevant concerns of Belt and Road initiatives. But after listening to Mr. Amari's speech, probably our, you know, what we really should be concerned about is what might be called digital Belt and Road initiatives rather than physical Belt and Road initiatives. And because this doesn't appear to be physically visible, but the implication for the world economy and implication for the content of world order based on freedom of information and freedom of speech. And, be more serious, I think, the freedom of or the continuing viability of liberal democratic systems. If cyberspace is virtually controlled by one authoritarian country, that could threaten the lives of all of us.
Thank you very much. So let me use that term that you just coined, the Digital Belt and Road Initiative, to bring all of the panelists into this conversation. And that is, how can Japan and the United States work together in addressing this challenge? I see very significant obstacles. Let me lay them out and I hope to get your reactions. One is that, in my opinion, the U.S. government is mostly trying to go alone in confronting China, and it's using one instrument primarily, and that is tariffs. And, you know, there is a risk that indeed there could be some kind of trade war between these two countries, and it might not actually even get to the substance of the issue, the root cause of these issues. Then when it comes to digital economy issues, of course, as Minister Amari highlighted, the TPP has very important rules in place, but the United States is not there. And then if you think about a possibility of the European Union, Japan and the United States working together, there are significant differences in how these countries look at the balance between freedom of flows and privacy. So it's not clear that you can bring them all to the same place and articulate and formulate rules. So given these challenges, that there are divisions among industrialized countries, that the United States seems to be pursuing a more unilateral tariff-oriented policy, what can we do to begin to address this very important challenge now and in the next years to come? Any suggestions, any plans of action? Please.
Well, I think I understand now really a delegation of high-ranking officials of the Trump administration in Beijing trying to present the U.S. concerns and list up all these things that the U.S. want China to do. As Mr. Amari mentioned, most of the things that Trump administration want had been included in TPP, and so much so, if Trump administration had not left TPP, the U.S. could have made its case much clearly with collective support of TPP 11 countries plus EU. And so, well, it's a rather moot to you know, think back on what could have been. But I think under the current circumstance, I personally wish well with the U.S. delegation to make their case as clearly possible to the Chinese leaders. But I think even from that on, I hope the Trump administration to consider the continuing relevance of collective demand on our Chinese friends. I think along with North Korean issues, but still there are a lot of rooms that the U.S. and EU and TPP 11 countries to work together.
Thank you very much. Minister Amari.
です。つまり付加価値を生んでいく源泉、資本、技術、情報、これを一方通行にさせないということです。
Well, this is actually quite simple. It is to make sure that it's not one way, meaning that the capital information and technology, that are the sources of value added. These should go, should flow both ways, not just one way.
皆さんは中国に投資をした会社、中国で儲けた利益をどのくらい本社、本国に持って帰れましたかって聞いたことありますか？
Have you ever asked companies who are investing in China of the profit that they make in China, how much can they bring back to their own country?
投資はウェルカムです。儲けたお金は中国に置いていけ、再投資をしていけっていうのは基本政策です。
Now this, their basic policy is that you're very welcome to earn money in China, but your profit stays here. You will reinvest.
つまり世界は資本と人材と技術を使って中国を一生懸命豊かにさせてやってるだけなんです。
So what the world is doing basically is using capital, people, and technology to make China more rich.
これからは情報が付加価値を生んでいきます。どれだけ濃密な情報をどれだけ大量に集められるかです。これを AI で分析することによって新たなソリューションが生まれてくるわけです。その付加価値をの源泉の情報を一方通行で集められるだけ集めるというルールを世界に敷いてはいけません。
So going forward, information is the very thing that will create value, added value. And these information that are more relevant and in volume will be analyzed by artificial intelligence to create new solutions. And so the information is really the source of added value, and the flow should never be one way around the world. And we should never create a system where information is flowing only one way.
中国ルールを中国圏内に全部敷いていく今野心が動き出しているわけです。逆らう国に対応するのは内政干渉です。中国共産党は昨年の共産党大会で外国内政不干渉政策から内政干渉政策に転換をしました。つまり不適切な内政なら中国がより良い方向に指導してあげるということです。
So the ambition of China is starting to move towards implementing Chinese rule to their sphere of influence. And they will resort to intervening to the domestic politics if those countries resisted to that rule. In the last party congress, they shifted their policy from not intervening to other countries' domestic policy to intervening to the other countries' domestic policies should they carry out inappropriate domestic policies. They will give them advice and instructions.
この手法として economic statecraft を使います。つまり中国に経済の依存状態を作らせます。相手の国が中国の方針と違う方針を打ち出した際には経済制裁をして遮断をします。無理やりにこちらに向かせるわけです。
So one of the tools they use is the economic statecraft. What it is that they, China would create economic dependency on their partner country. And if that particular country would go against Chinese will in terms of their direction, then they will impose economic sanction on the country so that they are forced to follow the rules.
南シナ海で中国に異を唱えたフィリピンは、フィリピンからの輸出している、バナナ、それが通関できずに留め置かれました。そうしているうちに全部腐りました。責任は、損害はフィリピンにあるだけです。
For example, Philippines went against the issue regarding the South China Sea against China. So as a result, their banana, one of their exports towards China, was stopped at the customs, and they stayed there until they rotted. And all the damage was on Philippines.
ダライラマの訪問を受け入れていたモンゴルは中国から経済援助を遮断されました。そしてその政策を転換せざるを得なくなりました。
Another example is Mongolia, where they used to accept the visit from Dalai Lama. China decided to cut the economic support to the country, and Mongolia was forced to change their policy.
まず経済依存状態を作る。そして意に沿わなければそれを遮断するという方法がEconomic statecraft です。
Economic statecraft again is to create economic dependency in different countries. And if they do not act accordingly, then they will cut off the economic support to those countries.
Thank you, Minister Amari. Minister Gemba or Ryan, do you have any comments?
先ほど言った一郎についてですね、一つは経済性、もう一つは中国のデジタルインフラについての言及がありましたけれど、もう一つ、川島先生なんかが、本来専門だと思いますけれど、もう一つ気をつけなきゃいけないのは、中国の軍港化というものをですね、軍の港ですね、やっぱりいくつかの国でそれらを図っていると。それはミャンマーでありスリランカでありパキスタンでありジブチです。
So regarding Belt and Road Initiative, we talked about its economy, and we also talked about digital infrastructure in China. One thing we need to also think about, of course, Mr. Kawashima is probably more of an expert in this area, but is about the China's building military ports around the world. Examples are Myanmar and Sri Lanka, Pakistan and Djibouti.
先ほど南シナ海、特にフィリピンの話がありましたけれど、もう一回ですね、皆さんに思い出してもらいたいのは、仲裁裁判所で中国のナインドットラインというのは否定をされましたけれど、中国は聞く耳を持っていない、この法の支配を受け入れないということについて、アメリカとしてあるいは世界全体としてどう考えるのかということはもう一度思い出さなければならないと思います。
As you recall, in the International Court, China's changing the status quo or landfill was denied, their right was denied. And the fact that China does not, and nine dot line was denied, the fact that China does not accept the rule of law will have to be considered, reconsidered again by the whole world as well as by the U.S.
だからこそ、その開かれた、ルールのもとにですね、中国をどう組み込んでいくかということについて、日米は協力をしなきゃいけないと、だからその一つが TPP だし、例えば WTO などもですね、今機能しておりません。
And that is all the more reason for Japan and the U.S. to work together and think about how we can include China into the rule that is more open for everybody. And one of such framework is TPP, also because WTO is not working very well currently.
議長は日本人です。外務省出身のですね。ですけど、委員の数が足りなくて、今 WTO を開けないでいるんですね。上級委員の任命についてアメリカがブロックしていると。これはアメリカにも責任があって、米国にはもっとしっかりしてもらいたいと思います。
Commissioner of WTO is Japanese person, but because of the lack of or shortage of members of the committee, WTO meetings itself cannot be held right now. And that is blocked by the U.S. for the moment. So U.S. has partial responsibility for WTO not working too well. So I would like to call out to U.S. to do better on this issue.
ぜひトランプ政権にはですね、目の前の中間選挙のことだけ考えるのではなくて、長期的な国家戦略として、もう一回ですね、地球社会を構想した米国を思い出してですね、国際社会の全体に通用するようなルールの形成者としての役割を期待をしたいと思います。
Again, I would like to call out to Trump administration not to just look at the upcoming midterm election, but to think more in the longer term regarding the national strategy to become once again the leader that led the global society and to be part of the countries that will form the global rule.
Thank you very much. Brian, do you have comments?
Sure. I would. I think this has already been a very rich discussion. I will just add two thoughts to what has already been said. The first is that for all the reasons I tried to outline at first, I think that it is a futile exercise to try to stop or obstruct the Belt and Road Initiative. It is going to happen. And the question in my mind isn't whether it's going to happen or not. It's how do we shift the conversation from a contest, great power contest, to a race to the top. In other words, make the focus on establishing competition so that the recipient countries have more than one option and don't end up trapped in debt for equity swaps, but are able to find a better path forward that serves their long-term interests. And then that leads me to my second thought, which is conceptual. I think that the focus of our efforts needs to be on finding ways to create a more dense and integrated trade and investment framework in Asia so that there's less space for any one country to isolate countries and dictate terms to them. The more that we can do so, and I think that TPP is a vehicle for doing so, the better both the United States and Japan will be strategically in the long term. And my final thought, I'm very confident that the United States will join TPP. I just can't tell you when. I think that Ambassador Amari and Minister Gimba have made a very persuasive case, and over time I think it will carry the day here.
So good American optimism. We can use a lot of that. Excuse me. So let me bring the audience. You have been very patient. I had many questions. I want to talk about aluminum and steel tariffs. I want to talk about the Motegi Lighthizer dialogue. But I have to cede that time because it's time for all of you to articulate your questions. If you can please raise your hand and the microphone will come to you. Identify yourself, very, very concise, and I'll take two questions at a time because we have just a few minutes left. So I have two gentlemen on this side in the front row and the fourth row.
Hi, Jesse Wu, a lead consulting, a privacy consulting firm. Given the focus on digital economies and digital integration, I'm curious what the Japanese government's perspective on the APEC cross-border privacy rules are. Mm-hmm. It seems like by facilitating information flows and data interoperability, that might be seen as a kind of counter to the Chinese information practices. So.
Thank you very much. And then the gentleman.
Thank you very much. My name is Neil Eifert, and I'm a retired Foreign Service officer from the U.S. Department of State. During the period 1993-97, I served in the State Department's Office for Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, APEC, and I witnessed a very successful, in my humble opinion, a very successful partnership whereby Japan and the U.S. co-chaired APEC. Numerous working meetings, numerous papers, and so forth. I wonder if this could be strengthened, revitalized, whatever the right word is. In other words, could we have some bold multilateralism here? It began, as people may know, in 1989 with the political objective of maintaining the presence of U.S. and Australia in Asia in the face of ASEAN and China, but it had a very real trade. Things were very real trade negotiations on difficult challenges, including most notably, but not only, agriculture. So I just throw that out and wonder if there's anyone interested in that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So interestingly, both questions on the potential of using APEC as another platform to pursue an economic dialogue that addresses digital issues and also other market opening exercises. Do you have any views on the potential of APEC?
TPP っていうのはもともと APEC から出てきたんですよね。
はい。
TPP originally came from APEC, right? Mm-hmm.
確かにまあ、再活性化するというのは一つの方法だと思いますけど、それで何か新しいものが生まれるかというと必ずしもそうではないのではないかという気がします。アメリカが TPP に入るのが一番簡単。
Well, yes, revitalizing APEC might be one thing, one method, but would that create something new at this point? I think at this point, the U.S. joining TPP will be even much simpler.
そういうハイスタンダードなルールの中に中国を組み込めば、中国は一定程度開かれたルールの中に入らざるを得なくなるということなんじゃないでしょうか。
And it goes further where we have this high standard rule, and if we can incorporate China into this set of rules, then they will be sort of forced to be in be a part of this open rule setup.
Thank you. Tanaka-san?
Well, the APEC is still a very useful regional framework because it has so many countries around the Pacific. So it has a certain role, but as Minister Gemba mentioned, at this particular moment, for the sake of creating better international rules relevant to the current date, probably we need much higher standards that not all APEC countries could easily agree, including China. So I think, as I agree with Mr. Gemba, the best thing is for the U.S. to rejoin TPP. And then maybe more broadly, if our interests exclude beyond APEC to include Indian Ocean countries, India and others, we may think of a much broader framework. But much broader framework, again, it's best be created by extending TPP. And sorry to say, the same thing repeatedly, but the best thing is for the U.S. to rejoin TPP.
The message is very clear. We have time for one more question. Here.
Thank you very much. I'm now Aoyama. Now it's Aoyama, staff writer for the Asahi Shimbun. When Mr. President Trump told his senior aides, including Mr. Lighthizer, to look into the possibility of rejoining the TPP, I think in mid-April, some saw that as a move to ratchet up the pressure on China. But I think in a press conference prior to the Japan-U.S. Summit meeting, Mr. Kudlow denied the link between the U.S.-China trade dispute and the TPP. He said the U.S. administration doesn't need the TPP to expedite to solve the U.S.-China dispute. So my question is, to what extent do you think the Trump administration really factors in the ongoing trade discussion with China when making their strategy toward the TPP?
If I can take a shot at answering that, I think that a lot of what is driving that conversation and why that issue comes to the president's mind is actually more domestic politics oriented. You have to take into account that that comment was made in addressing the concerns of farmers who were very worried about losing access to the Chinese market because there could be retaliatory tariffs. Farmers and agriculture producers are also very worried about the fate of the NAFTA agreement, and they're also very concerned about the possibility that they will not have the best terms of access to the Japanese market now that the United States is not in TPP. But I think that it's also very important to be realistic. It's important to be optimistic, but also realistic. The president shut the door very quickly with a tweet just a few hours later. And I think that there is a concern that as long as he is mostly thinking about bilateral trade deficits, he may lose on the possibility of
rule creation and making sure that American producers enjoy the best terms of access in overseas markets. So with that, I think we have to come to an end. So if you can please join me in thanking our excellent panelists this morning.